The other one allowed his eye to peer around the edge. It wasn't too hard to guess what he saw. Sirens announced the arrival of police cars. Okay, they probably had the perimeter forming now. Mrs. Daggett and her three women helpers had the kids in a single bunch on the corner, while the two subjects traded words. Good, that was smart. They weren't doing all that well, O'Day thought. One of them was always sweeping the room with eyes and muzzle, but they hadn't. Just then one of them reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out a photo. He said something else in whatever tongue they spoke. Then he closed the shades. Damn. That would prevent scoped rifles from seeing inside. They were smart enough to know that people might just shoot. Few of the kids here were tall enough to look out and... The one with the photo held it up again and walked toward the kids. He pointed. That one. Strangely, it was only now, it seemed, that they saw O'Day in the room. The knee-shot one blinked his eyes and aimed the AK right at him. The inspector took his arms from around his daughter's chest and held them up. "Enough people have been hurt, pal," he said. It didn't require all that much effort to make his voice shake. He'd made a mistake, too, holding his Megan that way. That fuck might shoot through her to get to me, he realized, a sudden wave of nausea ripping through his stomach at the thought. Slowly, carefully, he lifted her and moved her off his lap and onto the floor to his left. "No!" It was Marlene Daggett's voice. "Bring her to me," the man insisted. "Do it. Do it," O'Day thought. "Save your resistance for when it counts. It doesn't change anything right now." But she couldn't hear his thoughts. "Bring her," the shooter repeated. "No!" The man shot Daggett in the chest from a range of 3 feet. "What was that?" Price snapped. Ambulances were coming up Ritchie Highway now, their whooping sirens different from the monotonal screams of the police cars. Down to her left, state troopers were trying to get the road clear, shunting traffic away from the area while their hands rubbed on their holsters, wishing they were there to help. Their angry gestures conveyed their mental state to the puzzled drivers. Closer to Giant Steps, those immediately outside heard a renewed wave of screams, little kids in terror. For what reason, they could only guess. The leather jacket rode up when you were sitting down like this. If anyone had been behind him, he'd see the holster in the small of his back, the inspector knew. He'd never seen a murder before. He'd investigated his share of them, but to see one, a lady who worked with kids. The shock on his face was as real as any man's, watching life vanish. Innocent life, his mind added. So he really had no choice. When he next looked at Marlene Daggett, he wished that he might tell her that her murderers would not be leaving this building alive. It was miraculous that none of the kids were wounded as yet. All the shooting had gone high, and he realized that had Miss Anne not knocked him down, he might be dead beside his daughter now. There were holes in the wall, and the bullets that had made them would have transited the space he'd been in a second or two before. He looked down a second to see his hand shaking. His hands knew what they had to do. They knew their task, and they didn't understand why they weren't doing it, why the mind which commanded them hadn't yet given them the release. But his hands had to be patient. This was a job of the mind. The subject lifted Katie Ryan by her arm, wrenching it, making her cry out as he twisted it. O'Day thought about his first supervisor, working that first kidnapping case, Dom DiNapoli, that big, tough guinea who'd wept bringing the child back to her family. Never forget, they're all our kids. They might just as easily have selected Megan, they were so close. And that thought did cross from mind to mind, as the one with Sandbox looked at the photo again, and over toward Pat O'Day. "Who are you?" the voice demanded, while his partner moaned with increasing pain. "What do you mean?" the inspector asked in nervous reply. Looked dumb and scared. "Whose child is that?" he pointed at Megan. "She's mine, okay? I don't know who that one belongs to," the FBI agent lied. "She is the one we want. She is President's child, yes?" "How the hell should I know? My wife usually picks Megan up, not me. Do what you gotta do and get the fuck out of here, okay?" You inside, a female voice boomed from outside. This is the United States Secret Service. We want you to come out. You will not be hurt if you do. You have no place to go. Come out where we can see you, and you will not be hurt.
That's good advice, man, Pat told him. Nobody's gonna get out of here, you know.
You know who this girl is? She is daughter of your President Ryan. They will not dare shoot me, the subject proclaimed.
His English was pretty good, O'Day noted, nodding.
What about all the other kids, man? That's the only one you want. That's the only other one that matters. Hey, why not, you know, like, let some out, eh?
The man was partly right. The service guys wouldn't shoot at one target for fear that someone else might be in here, as one surely was, his rifle leveled at Pat's chest. And they were smart enough that they were never less than 5 feet apart. Shooting them would take two separate moves. What really scared O'Day was the casual, reflexive way he'd killed Marlene Daggett. They just plain didn't care. You couldn't predict that sort of criminal. You could talk to them, try to calm them down, distract them, but beyond that, there was only one way to deal with them.
We give them children. They give us car, yes?
Hey, that works for me, okay? I think that's just fine. I just want to get my daughter home tonight, you know.
Yes, you take good care of your little one. Sit there.
No problem.
He relaxed his hands, bringing them closer to his chest, right at the top of the zipper on his jacket. Undo that, and the leather would hang better, concealing his gun.
Attention, the voice called again. We want to talk.
Kathy Ryan joined her children in the helicopter. The agents' faces were grim enough. Sally and Jack were coming out of the initial shock and sobbing now, looking to their mother for solace as the Black Hawk leaped into the sky again, heading southwest for Washington with another in trail. The pilot, she saw, was not taking the usual route, but was instead going directly west, away from where Katie was. That was when Surgeon collapsed into the arms of her kids.
O'Day is in there, Jeffers told her.
You sure, Norm?
That's his truck. I saw him going in right before this went down.
Shit, Price swore. That's probably the shot we heard.
Yeah, Jeffers nodded grimly.
The president was in the Situation Room, the best spot to keep track of things. Perhaps he might have been elsewhere, but he couldn't face his office, and he wasn't president enough to pretend that...
Jack?
It was Robbie Jackson. He came over as his president stood, but they'd been friends much longer than that, and the two shared an embrace.
Been here before, man. It worked out then, too, remember?
We have tag numbers off the cars in the parking lot. Three are rentals.
We're running them now, Raymond said, a phone to his ear. Should be able to get some kind of ID.
How dumb might they be, O'Day asked himself. They'd have to be pretty fucking stupid to think they had any chance at all of getting out of here. And if they didn't have that hope, then they had nothing to lose. Not a damn thing. And they didn't seem to care about killing.
It had happened before in Israel, Pat remembered. He didn't recall the name or the date, but a couple of terrorists had had a bunch of kids and hosed them before the commandos were able to.
He'd taught tactics for every possible situation, or so he'd thought, and would have said as recently as 20 minutes before,
"But to have your only child next to you."
"They're all our kids," Dom's voice told him again. The unhurt killer had Katie Ryan by the upper arm. She was only whimpering now, exhausted from her earlier screams, almost hanging from his hand as the subject stood there to the left of the wounded one. His right hand held the AK. If he'd had a pistol, he could have held that weapon to her head, but the AK was too lengthy for that. Ever so slowly, Inspector O'Day moved his hand down, opening the zipper on his jacket. They started talking back and forth again. The wounded one was in considerable discomfort. At first, the adrenaline rush had blocked it out, but now things were settling down somewhat. And with the release of tension also went the pain-blocking mechanism that protected the body in periods of great stress. He was saying something, but Pat couldn't tell what it was. The other one snarled a reply, gesturing to the door, speaking with passion and frustration.
The scary part would come when they came to a decision. They might just shoot the kids. Those outside would probably rush the building if they heard more than a shot or two. They might be fast enough to save some of the kids, but... He started thinking of them as hurt and unhurt. They were pumped up, but confused, excited, but undecided, wanting to live, but coming to the realization that they would not. "Hey, guys," Pat said, holding his arms up and moving them to distract them from the open zipper. "Can I say something?" "What?" Hurt demanded, as Unhurt watched. "All these kids you have here. It's like too many to cover, right?" he asked, with an emphatic nod to get the idea across. "How about I take my little girl out and some of the others, okay? Make things easier for you, maybe." That generated some more jabbering. The idea actually seemed attractive to Unhurt, or so it appeared to O'Day. "Attention, this is the Secret Service," the voice called yet again. It sounded like Price, the FBI agent thought. Unhurt was looking toward the door, and his body language was leaning him that way. And to get there, he had to pass in front of Hurt. "Hey, come on, okay. Let some of us go, will you?" O'Day pleaded. "Maybe I can tell them to give you a car or something." Unhurt waved his rifle in the inspector's direction. "Stand," he commanded. "Okay, okay, be cool, all right." O'Day stood slowly, keeping his hands well away from his body. Would they see his holster if he turned around? The service people had spotted it the first time he'd come in. And if he fucked this one up, then Megan... There was no turning back. There just wasn't. "You tell them. You tell them they give us car, or I kill this one and all the rest. Let me take my daughter with me, okay?" "No," Hurt said. Unhurt said something in his native tongue, looking down at Hurt, his weapon still pointed at the floor, while Hurt's was aimed at O'Day's chest. "Hey, what you got to lose?" It was almost as though Unhurt said the same thing to his wounded friend, and with that he gave Katie Ryan a yank on the arm. She cried out loudly again as he walked across the room, pushing her ahead of him, blocking Hurt's field of view as he did so. It had taken 20 minutes to achieve. Now he had 1 second to see if it would work. The drill was the same for O'Day as it had been for Don Russell. His right hand raced back, whipped inside the jacket, and pulled the pistol out, as he dropped to one knee. The moment Unhurt's body cleared the target, the Smith 1076 loosed 2 perfect rounds, both of the stainless steel cases flying in the air, as Hurt became dead. Unhurt's eyes went wide in surprise as the children's screams erupted again. "Drop it!" O'Day bellowed at him. Unhurt's first reaction was to yank again at Katie Ryan's arm, and at the same time the gun started to move up, as though it were a pistol. But the AK was far too heavy to be used that way. O'Day wanted him alive, but there wasn't the time for chances. His right index finger pushed back on the trigger, then pushed again. The body fell straight down. Behind it, a red shadow on the white walls of giant steps. Inspector Patrick O'Day jumped across the room, kicking one, then the other rifle free of their dead owner's hands. He gave each body a careful look, and for all the years of practice and instruction he'd given and taken, it still came as a surprise that it all had worked. Only then did his heart start beating again, or so it seemed, as a vacuum filled his chest. His body slumped down for a moment. Then he tensed his muscles and knelt beside the body of Katie Ryan, sandbox to the Secret Service, and a thing to the people he'd just killed. "You okay, honey?" he asked. She didn't answer. She was holding her arm and sobbing, but there was no blood on her. "Come on," he said gently, wrapping his arms around a daughter who now would forever be partly his. Next he picked up his Megan and walked to the door. "They're shooting in the building," a voice said on the desk-mounted speaker. Ryan just froze. The rest of the people in the sit-room cringed. "Sounded like a pistol. Do they have pistols?" another voice asked on the same radio circuit. "Holy shit, look there! Who's that?" "Coming out," a voice called. "Coming out!" "Hold fire!" Price called over the loudspeaker. Guns didn't move away from the door, but hands relaxed a fraction.
"Jesus," Jeffers said, standing and racing to join him in the doorway.
"Both subjects dead. Mrs. Daggett, too," O'Day said. "All clear, Norm, all clear. Let me..."
"No!"
Katie Ryan screamed.
He had to get out of the way. Pat looked down to see the blood-soaked clothing of three agents of his rival agency. There were at least 10 rounds by Don Russell's body, and an empty magazine. Beyond were 4 dead criminals. 2, he saw, walking to the perimeter, headshots. He stopped by his pickup. His knees were a little weak now, and he set the kids down, sitting himself on the bumper. A female agent came up. Pat took the Smith from his belt and handed it over without really looking.
"You hurt?" It was Andrea Price. He shook his head. It took him a moment to speak again.
"I might start shaking in a minute."
The agent looked at his 2 little girls. A state trooper scooped Katie Ryan up, but Megan refused to leave his side. That was when he hugged his daughter to his chest, and the tears began for both of them.
"Sandbox is safe," he heard Price say. "Sandbox is safe and unhurt."
Price looked around. Backup service agents hadn't arrived yet, and most of the law enforcement personnel on the scene were troopers of the Maryland State Police in their starched khaki shirts. 10 of them formed a ring around Sandbox, guarding her like a pride of lions. Jeffers rejoined them. O'Day had never fully appreciated the way time changed in such moments as this. When he looked up, the children were being let out the side door. Paramedics were flooding the area, going to the children first.
"Here," the black agent said, handing over a handkerchief.
"Thanks, Norm." O'Day wiped his eyes, blew his nose, and stood.
"Sorry about that, guys."
"It's okay, Pat. You did better if I'd have taken the last one alive, but couldn't take the chance."
He was able to stand now, as he held Megan by the hand.
"Oh, damn," he added.
"I think we should get you out of here," Andrea observed. "We can do the interviews in a better place than this."
"Thirsty," O'Day said next.
He shook his head again.
"Never expected this, Andrea. Kids around. Not supposed to be this way, is it?"
Why was he babbling, the inspector asked himself.
"Come on, Pat, you did just fine."
"Wait a minute." The FBI inspector rubbed his face with 2 large hands, took a deep breath, and looked around the crime scene. Christ, what a mess. 3 dead just this side of the playground. That would be Jeffers, he thought, with his M16. Not bad. But there was one other thing he had to do. By each of the rented cars was a body, each a headshot. Another one round in the chest and 1 in the head, it looked like. The 4th, he wasn't sure who'd gotten him. Probably one of the girls. Ballistics tests would determine which one, he knew. O'Day walked back toward the front door, to the body of Special Agent Donald Russell. There he turned, looking back at the parking lot. He'd seen his share of crime scenes. He knew the signs, knew how to figure things out. No warning, not a damned bit, maybe a second, no more than that. And he'd stood his ground against 6 armed subjects and gotten 3 of them. Inspector Patrick O'Day knelt beside the body. He removed the SIG pistol from Russell's hand, gave it to Price, then took the hand in his own for what seemed a long time.
"See you around, champ," O'Day whispered, letting go after a few seconds. It was time to leave.
Chapter 43. Retreat. The nearest convenient place to land a Marine helicopter was the Naval Academy, and the hard part was finding available Secret Service personnel to ride with Sandbox. Andrea Price, senior agent on the crime scene as well as detail chief, had to stay at Giant Steps, so USSS personnel racing to Annapolis were diverted, met the state troopers at the academy, and took custody of Katie. And so it happened that the first team of federal officers to arrive at the scene were FBI agents from the small Annapolis office, a satellite of the Baltimore Field Division. What orders they needed, they took from Price.
But for the moment, their duties were straightforward, and quite a few more were on the way. O'Day walked across the street to the house which had been Norm Jeffers' local command post, whose owner, a grandmother, overcame her shock to make coffee. A tape recorder was set up, and the FBI inspector ran through an uninterrupted narrative, really just a long ramble, which was actually the best way to get fresh information. Later, they would walk him back through it, probing for additional facts. From where he was sitting, O'Day could see out the window. Ambulance crews were standing by to remove the bodies, but first, photographers had to record the event for posterity. They couldn't know that movie star was still looking down, along with what was now a crowd of several hundred, students and teachers from the community college, plus others who'd guessed the nature of the event and wanted to watch. Movie star had already seen enough, however, and he made his way to his car, picking his way across the parking lot, and then drove north on Ritchie Highway.
"Hey, I gave him a chance. I told him to drop his weapon," O'Day said. "I yelled so loud I'm surprised you didn't hear it outside, Price. But the gun started moving, and I wasn't in a mood to take chances, you know."
His hands were steady now. The immediate shock period was over. Others would come later. "Any idea who they were?" Price asked, after he'd gone through it the first time.
"They were talking in some language, but I don't know what one. Wasn't German or Russian. Aside from that, I don't know. Foreign languages sound like foreign languages. I couldn't recognize any words or phrases. Their English was pretty good, accented, but again, not sure what the accent was. Physical appearance, Mediterranean. Maybe from the Middle East. Maybe from some other place. Absolutely ruthless. He shot Mrs. Daggett down, not a blink, no emotion. No, that's wrong. He was pissed. Very pumped up. No hesitation at all. Boom, she's down. Nothing I could have done," the inspector went on. "The other one had his gun on me, and it happened so fast, I didn't really see that happening so fast."
"Pat," Andrea took his hand, "you did great."
The helicopter landed on the White House pad, just south of the ground floor entrance. Again, a ring of agents with weapons was in evidence, as Ryan ran to the aircraft while the rotor was still turning, and nobody tried to stop him. A Marine crewman in a green flight suit pulled the door open and stepped out, which allowed the agents on the helicopter to carry Sandbox off and hand her off to her father. Jack cradled her like the baby she no longer was, but always would be in his mind, and walked up the slope to the house, where the rest of his family was waiting under cover. News cameras recorded the event, though no reporter got within 50 yards of POTUS. The Secret Service members of the detail were in a mood to kill. For the first time in the memory of the White House press corps, they looked overly dangerous.
"Mommy!"
Katie twisted in her father's arms, reaching for her mother, who took her away from Jack at once. Sally and little Jack closed in on the pair, leaving their father standing alone. That didn't last for long.
"How you doing?" Arnie Van Dam asked quietly.
"Better now, I guess."
His face was still ashen, his body limp, but still able to stand.
"Do we know any more?"
"Look, first thing, how about we get all of you out of here? Up to Camp David. You can calm down there. Security is airtight. It's a good place to relax."
Ryan thought about that. The family hadn't been up there yet, and he'd only been there twice, most recently on a dreadful January day several years before.
"Arnie, we don't have clothes, or—"
"We can take care of that," the chief of staff assured him. The president nodded.
"Get it set up. Fast," he added.
While Kathy took the kids upstairs, Jack headed back out and over to the West Wing. 2 minutes later, he was back in the Situation Room. The mood was better there. The initial shock and fear were gone, replaced with a quiet determination.
"Okay," Ryan said quietly, "what do we know?"
"Is that you, Mr. President?" It was Dan Murray on the table-mounted speakerphone.
"Talk to me, Dan," Swordsman commanded. We had a guy inside, one of mine. You know him, Pat O'Day, one of my roving inspectors. His daughter, Megan, I think, goes there too. He got the drop on the subjects and blew them both away. The Secret Service people killed the rest. The total count is 9, 2 by Pat and the rest by Andrea's people. There are 5 service agents dead, plus Mrs. Daggett. No children were wounded, thank God. Price is interviewing Pat right now. I have about 10 agents on the scene to assist with the investigation, with a lot of service people on the way there, too.
Who runs the investigation? POTUS asked.
2 statutes on this one. An attack on you or any member of your family is under the purview of the Secret Service. Terrorism is our bailiwick. I'd give the service lead on this one, and we'll provide all possible assistance, Murray promised.
No pissin' contest on this one, my word on it. I've already called Justice. Martin will assign us a senior attorney to coordinate the criminal investigation.
Jack, the FBI director added.
What, Dan?
Get your family put back together.
We know how to do this. I know you're the president, but for the next day or two, just be a guy, okay?
Good advice, Jack, Admiral Jackson observed.
Jeff, Ryan said to Agent Raymond. All his friends were saying the same thing. They were probably right.
Yes, sir.
Let's get us the hell out of town.
Yes, Mr. President.
Raymond left the room.
Robbie, how about you and Sissy fly up, too? I'll have a helo waiting for you here.
Anything you say, pal.
Okay, Dan, Ryan told the speakerphone. We're going to Camp David. Keep me informed.
Will do, the FBI director promised.
They heard it on the radio. Brown and Holbrook were heading north on U.S. Route 287 to join Interstate 90 East. The cement truck drove like a pig, even with its multi-range gearbox, top-heavy, slow to accelerate, and almost as slow to brake. Maybe the interstate would be better driving, they hoped. But it did have a decent radio.
Damn, Brown said, adjusting the dial.
Kids. Holbrook shook his head.
We have to make sure no kids are around, Ernie.
I think we can handle that, Pete, assuming we can horse this rig all the way there.
What do you figure?
A grunt.
5 days.
Darii took it well, Badrine saw, especially with the news that all of them were dead.
Forgive me for saying so, but I did warn you that—
I know, I remember, Mahmud Haji acknowledged. The success of this mission was never really necessary, so long as the security arrangements were properly looked after.
With that, the cleric looked closely at his guest.
They all had false travel documents. None had a criminal file anywhere in the world, so far as I know. None had anything to connect him with your country.
Had one been taken alive, there was a chance, and I warned you about that, but it appears that none were.
The Ayatollah nodded and spoke their epitaph.
Yes, they were faithful.
Faithful to what? Badrine asked himself.
Overtly religious political leaders weren't exactly uncommon in this part of the world, but it was tiresome to hear. Now, supposedly, all 9 of them were in paradise. He wondered if Darii actually believed that.
He probably did. He was probably so sure that he believed that he could speak with God's own voice, or at least had told himself so often that he thought he did.
One could do that to himself, Ali knew, just keep repeating any idea enough, and however it had first entered one's mind, for political advantage, personal revenge, greed, any of the baser motivations, after enough repetitions it became an article of faith, as pure in purpose as the words of the prophet himself.
Darii was 72, Badrine reminded himself. A long life of self-denial, focused on something outside himself, continuing on a journey that had begun in his youth with shining purpose toward a holy goal.
He was a long way from the beginning now, and very close to the end. Now the goal could be seen so clearly that the purpose itself could be forgotten, couldn't it? That was the trap for all such men.
At least he knew better, Badrine told himself. For him it was just business, devoid of illusions and devoid of hypocrisy.
And the rest? Darii asked.
after a prayer for their souls.
"We will know by Monday, perhaps."
"Certainly by Wednesday," Ali replied.
"And security for that?"
"Perfect."
Badrine was totally confident. All of the travelers had returned safely, and reported in every case that their missions had been properly carried out. Whatever physical evidence they'd left behind, just the spray cans, would have been collected as trash and carted away. The plague would appear, and there would never be any evidence of how it might have gotten there. And so what had apparently failed today was not a failure at all. This Ryan fellow, relieved though he might be at the rescue of his child, was now a weakened man, as America was a weakened country, and Dariai had a plan. A good one, Badrine thought, and for his help in implementing it, his life would change forever now. His days as an international terrorist were a thing of the past. He might have some position in the expanding UIR government, security or intelligence probably, with a comfortable office and a sizable stipend, able finally to settle down in peace and safety. Dariai had his dream and might even achieve it. For Badrine the dream was closer still, and he need now not do a thing more to make it a reality. 9 men had died to make it so. That was their misfortune. Were they truly in paradise for their sacrificial act? Perhaps Allah truly was that merciful, enough to forgive any act done in his name, mistakenly or not. Perhaps. It didn't really matter, did it? They tried to make the departure look normal. The kids had changed clothes. Bags were packed and would go out on a later flight. Security looked tighter than usual, but not grossly so. That was mistaken. Atop the security building to the east and the old executive office building to the west, the Secret Service people who usually crouched were now standing, showing their full profiles as they scanned the area with their binoculars. Beside each was a man with a rifle. 8 agents were on the south perimeter fence, examining the people who were passing by or had come just to be there after hearing the horrid news, for whatever purpose. Most had probably come because they cared to some degree or another, maybe even to offer a prayer for the Ryan's safety. For those who had some other purpose, the agents watched, and this time, as with all the others, saw nothing unusual. Jack strapped in, as did the rest of his family. The engines over their heads started whining and the rotor turning. Inside with them were Agent Raymond and another guard, plus the Marine crew chief. The VH-3 helicopter vibrated, then lifted off, climbing rapidly into the westerly wind, first heading toward the OEOB, then south, then northwest, its curving flight path designed to confuse someone who might be out there with a surface-to-air missile. Light conditions were good enough that such a person would probably be spotted. It takes a few seconds to make a successful launch. And anyway, the helicopter was equipped with the newest variant of the black hole IR suppression system, which made Marine One a hard kill. The pilot, it was Colonel Hank Goodman again, knew all this, took the proper protective measures, and did his best to forget about it as he did so. It was quiet in the back. President Ryan had his thoughts. His wife had hers. The kids looked out the windows, for helicopter flying is one of the greatest thrill rides known to man. Even little Katie twisted in her seat belt to look down, her dreadful afternoon suppressed by the wonder of the moment. Jack turned, and seeing that, he decided that the short attention span of children was as much a blessing as a curse. His own hands were shaking a little now. Fear or rage, he couldn't tell. Kathy just looked bereft, her face slack in the golden light of sunset. Their talk tonight would not be a pleasant one. Behind them, a Secret Service car had collected Cecilia Jackson from their Fort Myers home. Admiral Jackson and his wife boarded a backup VH-60, along with some carry-on bags and more substantial luggage for the Ryan family. There were no cameras to record this. The President and First Family were gone, and the cameras with them,
while pundits put together their thoughts for the evening news broadcasts, trying to find a deeper significance in the events of the day, coming to conclusions well in advance of the federal officers, who only now were allowing the ambulance crews to remove the 13 bodies from the crime scene. The flashing police lights looked dramatic as TV crews set up to do live broadcasts, one of them from the very spot where Movie Star had observed the burned operation. He had prepared for this eventuality, of course. He drove north on Ritchie Highway. The traffic wasn't bad at all, considering the police still had the road blocked at Giant Steps. And at Baltimore-Washington International, he even had time to turn in his rental car and catch the British Airways 767 for Heathrow. Not first class this time, he realized. The aircraft was all business class. He didn't smile. He had hoped the kidnapping might actually succeed, though from the beginning he had planned also for its failure. For Movie Star, the mission hadn't failed at all. He was still alive, and escaping yet again. Here he was, lifting off, soon to be in another country, and there to disappear completely, even while the American police were trying to establish if there might have been another member of the criminal conspiracy. He decided to have a few glasses of wine, the better to help him sleep after a very stressful day. The thought that it was against his religion made him smile. What aspect of his life wasn't? Sunset comes quickly. By the time they started circling at Camp David, the ground was an undulating shadow punctuated by the stationary lights of private homes and the moving lights of automobiles. The helicopter descended slowly, flared out 50 feet above the ground, then settled vertically for a whisper-soft landing. There were few lights beyond the square landing pad's perimeter. When the crew chief opened the door, Raymond and the other agent stepped down first. The president undid his lap belt and walked forward. He stopped just behind the flight crew, tapping the pilot on the shoulder.
"Thanks, Colonel."
"You have a lot of friends, Mr. President. We're here when you need us," Goodman told his commander-in-chief. Jack nodded, went down the steps, and beyond the lights he saw the spectral outlines of Marine riflemen in camouflaged utilities.
"Welcome to Camp David, sir." It was a Marine captain.
Jack turned to help his wife down. Sally led Katie down. Little Jack came out last. It hit Ryan that his son was almost as tall as his mother now. He might have to call his son something else. Kathy looked around nervously. The captain saw it. "Ma'am, there's 60 Marines out there," he assured her. He didn't have to add what they were there for. He didn't have to tell the president how alert they were. "Where?" Little Jack asked, looking and seeing nothing. "Try this." The captain handed over his PVS-7 night vision goggles. Shortstop held them to his eyes.
"Cool."
His arm reached out, pointing to those he could see. Then he lowered the goggles, and the Marines turned invisible again.
"They're great for spotting deer, and there's a bear that wanders on and off the grounds every so often. We call him Yogi."
Captain Larry Overton, USMC, congratulated himself for calming them down, and led them toward the Humvees that would transport them to quarters. Yogi, he'd explain later, had a radio collar on so that he wouldn't surprise anybody, least of all a Marine with a loaded rifle. The quarters at Camp David appeared rustic, and truly were not anywhere near as plush as those in the White House, but could accurately be described as the sort of hideaway a millionaire might set up for himself outside Aspen. In fact, presidential quarters are officially known as Aspen Cottage. Maintained by Naval Surface Detachment, Thurmont, Maryland, and guarded by a short company of hand-picked Marines, the compound was as remote and secure a location as anything within 100 miles of Washington could possibly be. There were Marines at the presidential cabin to let them in, and inside were sailors to guide each to a private bedroom. Outside were 12 additional cottages, and the closer you were to Aspen, of course, the more important you were.
"What's for dinner?" Jack Jr. asked.
"Just about anything you want," a Navy chief steward replied. Jack turned to Kathy. She nodded. This would be a whatever-you-want night,
The president took off his jacket and tie. A steward darted up to collect them.
"The food is great here, Mr. President," he promised.
"That's a fact, sir," the chief confirmed. "We have a deal with some local folks. Fresh everything, right off the farm."
"Can I get you something to drink?" he asked hopefully.
"That sounds like a great plan, Chief. Kathy?"
"White wine?" she asked, the stress bleeding off her finally.
"We have a pretty good selection, ma'am. For domestic, how about a Chateau Saint-Michel Reserve Chardonnay? It's a 1991 vintage and about as good as a Chardonnay gets."
"You're a Navy chief?" POTUS asked.
"Yes, sir. I used to take care of admirals, but I got promoted. And if I may say so, sir, I do know my wines."
Ryan held up two fingers. The chief nodded and went out the door.
"This is insane," Kathy said after he left.
"Don't knock it."
While they waited for drinks, the two big kids agreed on a pizza. Katie wanted a burger and fries. They heard the buzz of another helicopter coming into the pad. Kathy was right, her husband thought. This is insane. The door reopened, and the chief returned with two bottles and a silver bucket. Another steward followed with glasses.
"Chief, I just meant two glasses."
"Yes, Mr. President, but we have two more guests arriving. Admiral and Mrs. Jackson. Mrs. Jackson likes a good white also, sir." He popped the cork and poured a splash for Surgeon. She nodded.
"Doesn't it have a wonderful nose?"
He filled her glass and one other, handing that to the president. Then he withdrew.
"They always told me the Navy had guys like that, but I never believed it."
"Oh, Jack." Kathy turned. The kids were watching TV, all three sitting on the floor, even Sally, who was trying to become an elegant lady. They were retreating into the familiar, while their parents did what parents always did, came to terms with a new reality, in order to buffer their children from the world.
Jack saw the lights of a Humvee go past to the left. Robbie and Sissy would have their own cabin, he imagined. They'd change before coming over. He turned back and wrapped his arms around his wife from behind.
"It's okay, babe."
Kathy shook her head.
"It'll never be okay, Jack. It'll never be okay again. Roy told me as long as we live we'll have bodyguards with us. Everywhere we go we'll need protection. Forever," she said, sipping her wine. Not so much angry as resigned. Not so much dazed as comprehending something she'd never dreamed. The trappings of power were seductive sometimes. A helicopter to work, people to take care of your clothes, look after your kids, whatever food you wanted as close as the phone. Escorts everywhere. Fast track into everything. But the price of it? No big deal. Just every so often somebody might try to murder one of your children. There was no running away from it. It was as though she'd been given a diagnosis of cancer, of the breast, the ovaries, something else. Horrible as it was, you had to do what you had to do. Crying didn't help, though she'd do a lot of that, Surgeon was sure. Screaming at Jack wouldn't help. And she wasn't a screamer anyway. And it wasn't Jack's fault, was it? She just had to roll with the punch, like patients at Hopkins did when you told them they had to go see the oncology department. "Oh, please don't worry. They're the best. The very best, and times have changed, and they really know what they're doing now." Her colleagues in the Department of Oncology were the best, and they had a nice new building now. But who really wanted to go there? And so she and Jack had a nice house of sorts, with a wonderful staff, some of whom were even wine experts, she thought, taking another sip from her glass. But who really wants to go there? So many agents were assigned to the case that they didn't know what to do yet. They didn't have enough rough information to generate leads, but that was changing fast. Most of the dead terrorists had been photographed. Two of them, shot from behind by Norm Jeffers' M16 rifle, didn't have faces to photograph, and all of the bodies fingerprinted. Blood samples would be taken for DNA records in case that later became useful. A possibility,
since identity could be confirmed by a genetic match with close relatives. For now, they went with the photos. These were transmitted to the Mossad, first of all. The terrorists had probably been Islamic, everyone thought, and the Israelis had the best data on them. CIA handled the initial notice, followed by the FBI. Full cooperation was promised at once, personally, by Avi Ben-Yakob. All of the bodies were taken to Annapolis for post-mortem examination. This was required by law, even in cases where the cause of death was as obvious as an earthquake. The pre-death condition of each body would be established, plus a full blood toxicology check to see if any were on drugs. The clothing of each was removed for full examination at the FBI laboratory in Washington. The brand names were established, first of all, to determine country of origin. That, and general condition, would determine time of purchase, which could be important. More than that, the technicians now working overtime on a Friday evening would use ordinary scotch tape to collect loose fibers, and especially pollen particles, which could determine many things, because some plants grew only in limited regions of the world. Such results could take weeks, but with a case such as this, there was no limit on resources. The FBI had a lengthy roster of scientific experts to consult. Tag numbers for the cars had been transmitted even before O'Day had done his shooting, and already agents were at the car rental agencies checking the computerized records. At Giant Steps, the adult survivors were being interviewed. They mainly confirmed O'Day's reportage. Some of the details were askew, but that was not unexpected. None of the young women recognized the language the terrorists had spoken. The children were subjected to far gentler interrogations, in every case sitting on a parent's lap. Two of the parents were from the Middle East, and it was thought that perhaps the children knew something of foreign languages. But that proved to be a false hope. The weapons had all been collected and their serial numbers checked with a computerized database. The date of manufacture was easily established, and the maker's records checked to see which distributor had purchased them, and from there which store had sold them. That trail proved cold indeed. The weapons were old ones, a fact belied by their new condition, which was established by visual inspection of the barrel and bolt mechanisms. They hardly had any wear at all. That tidbit of information went up the line even before they had a purchaser's name. "Damn, I wish Bill was here," Murray said aloud, for the first time in his career feeling inadequate to a task. His division chiefs were arrayed around his conference table. From the first, it was certain that this investigation would be a joint venture between the criminal and foreign counterintelligence divisions, aided, as always, by laboratory. Things were moving so rapidly that there wasn't yet a Secret Service official to join them. Thoughts?
"Dan, whoever bought these guns has been in country a long time," FCI said. "Sleeper." Murray nodded agreement. "Pat didn't recognize their language. He would probably have recognized a European one." "Has to be the Middle East," criminal said. This wasn't exactly Nobel-class work, but even the FBI had to follow form in what it did. "Well, Western Europe, anyway. I suppose we have to consider the Balkan countries." There was reluctant agreement around the table. "How old are those guns again?" the director asked.
11 years, long before the ban was passed," criminal answered for FCI. "They may have been totally unused until today. Virgins, Dan."
"Somebody set up a network that we didn't know about. Somebody real patient. Whoever the purchaser turns out to be, I think we'll find that it's a nicely faked ID, and he's already flown the coop. It's a classic intelligence job, Dan," FCI went on, saying what everybody was thinking. "We're talking pros here."
"That's a little speculative," the director objected.
"When's the last time I was wrong, Danny?" the assistant director asked.
"Not lately. Keep going."
Maybe the lab guys can develop some good forensic stuff. He nodded to the assistant director for the laboratory division. But even then, what we're going to end up with won't be good enough to take into a court, unless we get real lucky and bag either the purchaser or the other people who had to be involved in this mission. Flight records and passports, criminal said. 2 weeks back for starters. Look for repeaters. Somebody reconned the objective. Must have been since Ryan became president. That's a start. Sure, he didn't go on, only about 10 million records to check. But that was what cops did. Christ, I hope you're wrong on the sleeper, Murray said, after a further moment's reflection. So do I, Dan, FCI replied. But I'm not. We'll need time to ID his house, assembly point, whatever, interview his neighbors, check the real estate records to come up with a cover name and try to proceed from there. He's probably already gone, but that's not the scary part, is it? 11 years at least he's been here. He was bankrolled. He was trained. He kept the faith all the way to today to help with that mission. All that time, and he still believed enough to help kill kids. He won't be the only one, Murray concluded bleakly. I don't think so. Will you come with me, please? I've seen you before, but... Jeff Raymond, sir. The Admiral took his hand. Robbie Jackson. The agent smiled. I know that, sir. It was a pleasant walk, though it would have been more so without the obvious presence of armed men. The mountain air was cool and clear, lots of stars blinking overhead. How's he doing? Robbie asked the agent. Tough day. A lot of good people dead. And some bad ones, too. Jackson would always be a fighter pilot, for whom inflicted death was part of the job description. They turned into the presidential quarters. Both Robbie and Sissy were struck by the scene. Not parents themselves. Cecilia's medical problem had not allowed it, despite the best of efforts. They didn't fully understand how it was with kids. The most horrific events, if followed by a parent's hug and other signs of security, were usually set aside. The world, especially for Katie, had resumed its proper shape. But there would be nightmares, too, and those would last for weeks, maybe longer, until the memories faded. Embraces were exchanged, and then also, as usual, man paired with man and woman with woman. Robbie got himself a glass of wine and followed Jack outside. How are you doing, Jack? By unspoken agreement, here and now, Ryan wasn't the president. The shock comes and goes, he admitted. It's all come back from before. The bastards can't just come after me. Oh, no, they have to go for the soft targets. Those cowardly fucks! Jack cursed as it came back again. Jackson sipped at his glass. There wasn't a whole hell of a lot to be said right now, but that would change. It's my first time here, Robbie said, just to say something. My first time. Would you believe we buried a guy up here? Jack remarked, remembering. He was a Russian colonel, an agent we had in their defense ministry. Hell of a soldier. Hero of the Soviet Union. 3 or 4 times, I think. We buried him in his uniform with all the decorations. I read off the citations myself. That's when we got Gerasimov out. The KGB head. So that's true, eh? Yep. Ryan nodded. And you know about Columbia, and you know about the submarine. How the hell did those newsies find out, though? Robbie almost laughed aloud, but settled for a chuckle. Holy God, and I thought my career was eventful. You volunteered for yours, Jack observed crossly. So did you, my friend. Think so? Ryan went back inside for a refill. He returned with the night vision goggles and switched them on, scanning the surroundings. I didn't volunteer for having my family guarded by a company of Marines. There's 3 of them down there. Flak jackets, helmets, and rifles. And why? Because there's people in the world who want to kill us. Why? Because... I'll tell you why. Because you're better than they are, Jack. You stand for things, and they're good things. Because you've got balls, and you don't run away from shit. I don't want to hear this, Jack, Robbie told his friend. Don't give me this oh-my-God stuff, okay? I know who you are. I'm a fighter pilot because I chose to be one. You're where you are because you chose to. Nobody ever said it was supposed to be easy, okay? But my ass, Mr. President. There's people out there who don't like you. Okay, fine. You just figure out how to find them, and then you can ask those Marines out there to go take care of business. You know what they'll say. You may be hated by some, but you're respected and loved by a lot more. And I'm telling you now, there's not one person in our country's uniform who isn't willing to dust anybody who fucks with you and your family. It's not just what you are, it's who you are, okay? Who am I? Swordsman asked himself. At that moment, one of his weaknesses asserted itself. Come on. Ryan walked over to the west. He'd just seen a sudden flare of light. And 30 seconds later, at the corner of another cabin, he found a Navy cook smoking a cigarette. President or not, he wasn't going to be overly proud tonight. Hello? Jesus, the sailor blurted, snapping to attention and dropping his smoke into the grass. I mean, hello, Mr. President. Wrong the first time, right the second time. Got a smoke? POTUS asked, entirely without shame, Robbie Jackson noted. You bet, sir. The cook fished one out and lit it. "Sailor, if the First Lady sees you do that again, she'll have the Marines shoot you," Jackson warned. "Admiral Jackson." Those words made the kid brace again. "I think the Marines work for me. How's dinner going?" "Sir, the pizza is being cut right now. Baked it myself, sir. They ought to like it," he promised. "Settle down. Thanks for the cigarette." "Any time, sir." Ryan shook his hand and wandered off with his friend. "I needed that," Jack admitted, somewhat shamefully, taking a long drag. "If I had a place like this, I'd use it a lot. Almost like being at sea," Jackson went on. "Sometimes you go outside, stand on one of the galleries off the flight deck, and just sort of enjoy the sea and the stars. The simple pleasures." "It's hard to turn it off, isn't it? Even when you went communing with the sea and the stars, you didn't turn it off, not really." "No," the Admiral admitted. "It makes thinking a little easier, makes the atmosphere a little less intense. But you're right, it doesn't really go away. And it didn't now, either. Tony said India's Navy's gone missing on us. Both carriers at sea, with escorts and oilers. We're looking for them." "What if there's a connection?" Ryan asked. "With what?" "The Chinese make trouble in one place, the Indian Navy goes to sea again, and this happens to me. Am I being paranoid?" Swordsman asked. "Probably. Could be the Indians put out when they finished their repairs, and maybe to show us that we didn't teach them all that big a lesson. The China thing, well, it's happened before, and it's not going anywhere, especially after Mike Dubrow gets there. I know Mike. He'll have fighters up and poking around. The attempt on Katie? Too early to say, and it's not my field. You have Murray and the rest for that. In any case, they failed, didn't they? Your family's in there, watching TV, and it'll be a long time before somebody tries anything else." It was becoming an all-nighter all over the world. In Tel Aviv, where it was now after 4 in the morning, Avi Ben-Yakob had called in his top terrorism experts. Together they went over the photos transmitted from Washington and were comparing them with their own surveillance photographs that had been taken over the years in Lebanon and elsewhere. The problem was that many of their photos showed young men with beards, the simplest method of disguise known to man, and the photos were not of high quality. By the same token, the American transmitted images were not exactly graduation pictures either. "Anything useful?" the director of Mossad asked. Eyes turned to one of the Mossad's experts, a 40-ish woman named Sarah Peled. Behind her back, they called her the witch. She had some special gift for IDing people from photographs,
and was right just over half the time in cases where other trained intelligence officers threw up their hands in frustration.
This one.
She slid two photos across the table. This is a definite